Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, and Embedded is back. President Donald Trump has no record of public service, but he does have a record in business and on TV. In our latest round of stories, we introduce you to the people who were there as he built an empire and a name. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm here in the studio with Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop. And Marlon, you took a trip recently to one of my all-time favorite places in the world. It's the Dominican Republic. And we're going to be looking into this story for the entire hour because it's a really complicated one.
That's right. And I want to start by talking about something that happened on one of the first days I was there.
What happened?
I'm in the capital, Santo Domingo, and I see a billboard that just really kind of takes my breath away.
What does the billboard say?
It says, "Without a border, there's no country." And then in bigger letters, "The wall, border control."
Wait. So just like the wall symbolizes border control? And what does that mean?
Well, it was a billboard for this politician whose name is Pellegrin Castillo. And what it means is that he wants to build a wall on the border. It turns out he's kind of this right-wing Dominican Trump figure of sorts. I looked him up,
Pellegrin Castillo,
and I visited his office.
Vicepresidente de la Fuerza Nacional Progresista.
That's him. That's Pellegrin. He's a former member of the Dominican legislature. He runs this far-right party that has this anti-immigrant stance. And, you know, I asked around, and a couple people told me he was kind of seen as this sort of crazy guy. There's paintings all over his office of the Dominican founding fathers, Spanish-looking guys with kind of cool hair.
Parece que el señor Trump oyó la propuesta dominicana.
He thinks that Trump learned from the Dominicans about the wall.
I mean, he's kind of joking, but, you know, he said that he's been asking for a wall since the 90s. And so he's like, maybe Trump copied it from me. And of course, you know, the border that he wants to build a wall on is Haiti.
Haiti and the Dominican Republic are one island that is divided in half, essentially. And this is where this politician wants to put the wall.
It's an island, but it's like really populated. There's, you know, about 10 million people in Haiti. There's 10 million people in the DR. And there's a lot of, you know, poverty and pressure in Haiti that leads people to migrate to the DR to work.
Ellos deprimen el salario.
He talks about Haiti is depressing wages of Dominican workers. And he also said this one thing that I thought was a little eerie.
Nosotros queremos una buena convivencia, una convivencia que evite conflictos mayores. Entonces, un muro.
He says we want to get along with Haiti well, and we want to avoid conflicts. In a perfect world, there would be no walls. But we have to build a wall to keep order, because if not, there's going to be another kind of wall.
Un muro sangriento en el futuro.
A wall of hate and a wall of blood.
That's very dramatic.
And the truth is, things are really tense in the DR right now around immigration. You know, you talk to a lot of average Dominicans and they feel really strongly that they don't want Haitians living in their country.
And the other thing is that Haitians have been in the Dominican Republic really for decades upon decades upon decades.
Absolutely. We know that there are a lot of stories about tensions like this, you know, hatred that happens across borders. It seems to happen all over the world, right? And I think we tend to think of this as like one of the worst aspects of human nature, which is that you put two people and you draw a line in between them and they're going to grow to hate each other. So the story I want to tell today is about those lines. Who does the drawing? And what are the consequences for all of us? In specific, we're going to focus on how one man, Rafael Trujillo, the former dictator of the Dominican Republic, did something terrible exactly 80 years ago. Something so terrible that to this day, people don't want to talk about it. And this single event shaped the Dominican-Haitian border as we know it.
So tell us how this story starts.
Okay, to start off, we need to meet
Edward Paulino.
He's Dominican-American.
And I am proudly a historian.
Specifically, he studies the Dominican-Haitian border. His book, Dividing Hispaniola, is actually what got me interested in this whole topic in the first place. And Edward can point to the moment that the border called to him.
I was a sophomore, maybe, in college, and my advisor invited me to visit the FDR Presidential Library. And there I discovered for myself a document.
The document was a telegram sent in 1937 from the U.S. ambassador in the Dominican Republic to the State Department,
saying that there was a campaign of extermination.
A, quote, systematic campaign of extermination, end quote.
And that's the red pill. I went into the rabbit hole.
Edward became obsessed with wanting to learn everything about this massacre. He decided he wanted to go to the border and see for himself what happened. And growing up in a Dominican household, he heard things about the border that kind of painted it as a scary place.
Why are you going to the border? Don't you know that at the border they eat people?
And so had you heard growing up about the massacre at all, like as,
no,
as a Dominican American?
No massacre.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Time to back up. So the way this all started is that back in the day, the Spanish arrived in what is today the Dominican Republic. It's actually the first Spanish colony in all the Americas. They colonized half the island, and the French colonized the other half. Both sides brought large numbers of enslaved Africans to work, but especially the French, and it became the wealthiest colony of the French Empire. But not for long, because in 1804, there was the Haitian Revolution. It was the most successful slave revolt in modern history, maybe ever. And after the Haitians kick out the French, they look over on the other side of the island and they think, we probably don't want a European power over there.
They want to be free, but the Haitians also feel that they need to control the island because they don't want slavery.
So in 1822, Haiti invades the other Spanish-controlled half of the island, what is today the Dominican Republic. They kick out the Spanish and they rule over the unified island for 22 years. They end slavery. But eventually, Dominicans push the Haitians back and declare their independence. To this day, actually, Dominicans celebrate their independence not from Spain, who is their colonizer, but from Haiti.
And so by 1844, you have this idea of Dominicanness expelling Haitians.
Let's fast forward now to 1930, when a general in the Dominican military named Rafael Trujillo seizes power.
From the ancient Spanish fortress, built more than 400 years ago, comes the car of Rafael Trujillo Molina, the strong man of the Republic.
Trujillo was a total megalomaniac. He had the capital city, Santo Domingo, renamed after him. It became Ciudad Trujillo. He also renamed the country's highest mountain after himself, and he did things like force the country's merengue orchestras to compose songs in his honor. And nowadays, most people look back at Trujillo as one of the great villains of Latin American history. He ran a police state, killed thousands of his own citizens. He's also said to have been obsessed with whitening the Dominican Republic and even powdered his face to have a more Spanish appearance. And a side note about that. So most Dominicans are of at least partial African ancestry. But the country for much of its history has had this very Eurocentric identity. Part of that is just regular old-fashioned racism, but a lot of it was about the presence of Haiti next door. And some Dominican thinkers have told me, you know, Dominicans saw how the world isolated Haiti, and they said to themselves, look, if we can define ourselves as white, or at least whiter, things will be much better for us. But at the beginning of Trujillo's rule, in terms of his relationship with Haiti, things started out really positive. In 1935, the two nations even signed a border treaty.
You know, someone even nominated President Trujillo and President Vincent of Haiti for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Trujillo visited Haiti and bragged about having a Haitian grandmother. He declared his love for the Haitian people and kissed the Haitian flag. But the border with Haiti became a kind of fixation for him. So I spoke to another historian, Richard Turritz, and he explained to me that back in Trujillo's time, many of the people who lived in the border area of the Dominican Republic were actually Haitian.
Most Haitians there were not migrants. Most Haitians had lived there for generations and things had been very peaceful.
Kids might live in the DR and then casually cross over to go to school in Haiti, or vice versa. At the time, Haiti was actually a wealthier country than the DR, and many of the Haitians there were fairly well off.
You have cattle ranches that straddle both sides of the border. You have, you know, families and communities that ignore the border in a way that's very difficult for Trujillo, who, despite the harmony between the two states, was very interested in hardening the border.
He wanted to harden the border because, for one, he was paranoid that political enemies could cross back and forth and plot to overthrow him. And also, maybe most importantly, Turritz says, he controlled everything in the country, and it grated him that he couldn't control this one thing.
In the end, I think it was this transnationalism which was so upsetting to Trujillo, the fact that the border was really a political fiction. And after the massacre, Trujillo is reported to have said, "Now let them say we have no borders."
And so, on October 2nd, 1937, it began.
There's a story that Trujillo was already doing a tour of the border in early October. He was in Dajabón, in what is called like the city hall, this official building and a party. And so he stops and he stands up. He says, "I have heard Dominican farmers, their cattle being stolen. No more." He stomps his foot.
According to the story, that stomp marked the beginning of the massacre. On Trujillo's order, the Dominican army in the northwest of the country, especially near the border, went town to town looking for Haitians. Today, this massacre is known in textbooks as the Perejil, or Parsley, Massacre.
Haitians and Dominicans can look alike, right? Dominicans are the majority of African descent. So how do you know a Haitian is a Dominican?
And so there was this test. If soldiers suspected somebody of being Haitian, they would ask them to pronounce the word
Perejil. And so in Haitian Creole, the R's are not as, you know, you can't roll them as hard as a Spanish speaker. And so the thinking was, if he or she mispronounced Perejil, then they were taken away or killed on the spot.
So a lot of people doubt if this story is true because Haitians living in the border region for many years would have spoken Spanish fluently. What is true is that Dominican soldiers killed innocent Haitian families.
They were rounded up and they were summarily executed.
And there are all sorts of horror stories, which are hard to verify, of soldiers throwing babies in the air and impaling them on bayonets, or making people dig their own graves. Civilians were recruited to help the military burn the bodies. And according to some scholarly accounts, they may have participated in some of the killings as well. Edward Paulino, when he was doing his dissertation research, he interviewed several people who claimed to have participated in the killings.
The military gave them, these civilians, cartridges for shotguns. But you had to prove that you had used the cartridge. To show them that you killed Haitians, you had to bring back the ears of those you killed. If you killed two Haitians, you had to bring back 3 ears.
And on the other side, there were civilians who resisted.
And you had Dominicans who risked their lives to save their neighbors by saying, "Don't go there, I saw the patrol," etc.
The killing stopped after about 8 days. Later estimates of the dead would vary wildly, from a few thousand up to 12,000 or even 30,000.
They murdered them there, usually by machetes. The state already was thinking about an excuse, saying this was not a military operation. The killings were just Dominican patriotic farmers defending their lands from Haitian marauders.
The local press, which Trujillo controlled, did not report on the government's role in the massacre and insisted that the story was about fed-up locals rising up against Haitian cattle thieves. The United States, under pressure from Haiti, urged Trujillo to pay an indemnity of $525,000 to the Haitian government, worth about $9 million today. The dictator reluctantly paid, but refused to apologize. Trujillo stayed in power for another 24 years, and during that time, nobody could investigate the massacre. After his death, scholars started digging through documents and doing interviews and kind of trying to piece together what happened. But there were large pieces of the puzzle missing. The biggest piece was the bodies. They were never found. And that has made it very easy for people to say, well, this didn't happen, or at least not on the scale people are claiming that it did. And so I wanted to go to the border myself. I couldn't exactly go around trying to dig up bodies, so I did the next best thing. I went looking for survivors.
Coming up on Latino USA, we hear from some of those survivors. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Latino USA is part of an independent nonprofit media organization committed to creating narrative journalism that represents the new American mainstream. We are proud to bring honest, hard facts to our listeners. Please support our work and donate today. Go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. And consider supporting us with a monthly gift. We love hearing from our listeners, like Sharon Hannick, who shared on Facebook, "Don't let the Latino in the title fool you. This podcast touches the lives of everybody in the USA." Thank you, Sharon. If you also love our work, please donate today at latinousa.org. Every penny counts towards our award-winning journalism.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm here today with producer Marlon Bishop. And we're talking about the Haitian-Dominican Massacre of 1937. Now, when we left off, Marlon was talking about the fact that no bodies have ever been found after the massacre. So Marlon decided to head to the border himself to see if he could find any survivors.
That's right. So before I left, I started digging around, and eventually I got in touch with a woman named Nancy Betances. She's from the border area, does volunteer work with local NGOs. And when I called her up, she said, "No problem. I can definitely help you find survivors." So I flew to Santo Domingo and rented a car and drove about 5 hours up through the Cibao Valley and over the mountains to a small city on the border called Dajabon. I arrived at night, and when I got there, I met up with Nancy.
Nancy Betances.
And a friend of hers, who she invited to help on our mission.
Mi nombre es Stevenson Pierre.
Stevenson is in his 20s, from the Haitian side of the border, but goes to university on the Dominican side. Nancy is Dominican, in her 40s, with a light complexion and dyed blondish hair. And Nancy and Stevenson have formed a kind of unlikely friendship. It's unlikely because
he aprendido sobre esta historia con mi abuelo.
Stevenson's grandfather was himself a survivor of the Haitian massacre. And Nancy,
mira, mi abuelo se llamaba Rafael Enrique Betances Abreu.
Her grandfather was a chief in the Dominican military stationed at the border at the time.
Y él tuvo que participar y matar.
And he killed Haitians during the massacre. And the amazing thing is that their grandfathers were from the exact same town, but on different sides of the conflict. And sitting down with Nancy and Stevenson, I wanted to know, what were the scars that the massacre left? How do Haitians and Dominicans here at the border see each other today, 80 years after the killings?
Antes, yo me acuerdo que cuando uno se portaba mal, también le decía, ahí viene un haitiano.
When she was a kid, Nancy says she remembers that if you behaved badly, your parents would say, if you keep acting this way, the Haitians are going to get you. And among Haitians, Stevenson says, Dominicans have this reputation of being kind of violent and racist.
Por ejemplo, si tienes un cuchillo, tienes sangre dominicano porque tú le gustas jugando con cuchillo.
If somebody in Haiti has a knife or is playing with knives, people will say, you must have Dominican blood because you like knives. And in fact, at the border, the massacre is not known at all as the Parsley Massacre, but El Corte, the cutting. And Nancy is not proud of her family's role in this. Today, she actually volunteers for groups that work with Haitian immigrants.
Yo me siento que quizás yo trabajo con los haitianos es porque tengo algo que saldar, una deuda.
She says that maybe she works with Haitians because she has a debt to pay because of what her grandfather did. Over the days I spent with Nancy, I learned that she was a bit of a busybody, somebody who likes to stick her nose in places where it wasn't necessarily invited. And this trait, which might be super annoying, say, in a neighbor, was actually really helpful in a guide for the Dominican border.
Y si por parte del país, de las autoridades, han querido como... que eso se olvide, que eso se le eche tierra.
She says the authorities of this country want the massacre to be forgotten, to be covered up.
¿Y por qué me interesa? Porque es algo de que no quieren hablar.
And the fact that people don't want to talk about it, that's what interests her. We made a plan. First, I would go with Stevenson to Haiti to interview survivors there. And then Nancy would take me around and do the same, but on the Dominican side. The next day, bright and early, I meet up with Stevenson at the foot of the international bridge leading to Haiti.
Hoy es el día del mercado binacional.
It's Monday, which is the day of the weekly binational market. So there's lots of people crossing back and forth to buy and sell goods. We're theoretically allowed to cross, but we weren't sure if the border guards would give us any trouble about our recording equipment. So we try to fly under the radar.
So we're walking across the bridge, crossing into Haiti, and nobody has asked us for any document. And the plan is if someone tries to stop us, we just say we're going to a meeting and they'll let us through. And it seems like this plan works flawlessly.
By the way, that river we just crossed, it's called the Massacre River.
Ya estamos en Haití.
Guanamet, the town on the Haitian side, isn't too different from Dajabón, which is the town on the Dominican side. There's lots of motorcycles here, domino games, though the streets and buildings are noticeably in worse shape. Stevenson seems to loosen up right away once we cross into Haiti. The first stop of the day is his grandfather's house, who, remember, was a survivor himself. Stevenson's grandfather is named Francisco Pierre. He's 90 years old, mostly blind, can't move much. But when we asked him to tell us the story about what happened to him during the massacre, he remembered it as if it were yesterday. By the way, we've hired a voice actor to translate his story.
Dominicans never used to work. It was Haitians who used to farm and work.
Francisco's family was typical of the area. They were mixed, Dominican and Haitian, and had lived in the border area for a really long time. And because of that, they were completely surprised by what happened.
And then, it's like that.
On October 5th, 1937, we saw an Haitian man pass by, and he yelled out to my uncle, "Go across to Haiti right now, because they are killing people in the village." We went further up to here, and sure enough, the village was boiling with noise. They were killing every last Haitian in the village. So we grabbed the donkey, filled our gunny sacks, and tied it to him. I had a little gourd filled with rice and put it around my shoulder, and we were off.
Francisco and his grandmother started walking. Other Haitians who were fleeing joined them. And as they went along, all of a sudden, two Dominicans approached.
One boy was on a mule and the other on a horse, and they said, "Stop right there, stop right there." I immediately ran off with my calabash filled with rice in my hands. When I reached my grandmother, I got a hold of myself. I was trembling. I was only 10. I trembled and trembled. One of the Dominicans went to approach us and menace us. The other one lagged behind.
The Dominican who lagged behind recognized one of the Haitian women who had joined the group. Some time ago, the Dominican had been riding by this Haitian woman's house and fallen off his horse and injured himself. And she took him in and nursed him back to health. Now, in front of her, under orders to kill any Haitians he saw, he couldn't do it and started crying.
The other Dominican heard him crying and asked what he was blubbering about. He said, "That woman, I cannot kill her. She treated me with great kindness once. Once I was sick, and it was she who picked me up. So I cannot kill
her."
The Dominicans spared the group, and they took off running.
We ran and ran and ran and ran. When we arrived far, we started to cheer. And they yelled from afar to keep going, because if we let other Dominicans find us, we'd be in trouble.
The group continued on, descending a steep hill.
We went down and approached a body of water, which was the border between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. When we arrived, we saw a bunch of dead bodies. There were a bunch of Haitians on the Haitian side yelling, "Come, come, the guards are coming, and if they catch you, they will kill you." But we stood there immobile. Before we knew it, the Haitians crossed over and grabbed our donkeys and grabbed our hold of our hands and pulled us across. No sooner than we made it across, the Dominicans that were killing people showed up.
Francisco and his grandmother narrowly escaped. And after they crossed, they went to the Haitian police, who took down their names. Eventually, in Haiti, he would go by Francisque instead of Francisco. The local mayor brought them to a place where they could build a house. And here in Haiti, they remade their life, starting from scratch. And since then, he says he's only returned to the DR once to go to a hospital when he was very ill. And the reason he hasn't wanted to go back is because he's terrified of the DR.
I was afraid of Dominica.
Francisco's story was a little slice of living proof about what happened. And at 90 years old, he's probably one of few people alive today who lived through the massacre and is old enough to remember it. Over the rest of the day, we spoke to several others who also said they were survivors. We found them in Dos Monts, a town 20 minutes away that residents say was set up as a refugee camp for people fleeing the massacre. Their stories were similar to Francisco's. Total surprise at the attack, narrow escapes across to Haiti, and relatives they never saw or heard from again. The next day, I went out with Nancy, the Dominican woman we met earlier whose grandfather participated in the killings. And I wanted to learn about what happened during the massacre from the other side and why many Dominicans don't want to talk about it. As we drive through the forested mountains near the border, she points to orchards of mango trees along the road. You see all those mango trees? They were planted by Haitians, who were the original owners of these lands. All of a sudden, when the Haitians were kicked off, it made the Dominicans richer because they were able to take the lands that were left behind. After an hour driving through these really beautiful landscapes, we arrive at the house of a woman named
Paulina Recio.
Paulina was 4 years old when the massacre happened. Today, the place she lives is called Restauración, Restoration. But back when she was growing up here, it was
Gurabo Francais, Gurabo.
In fact, most of the place names in the border area used to have French or Creole-sounding names, and they were changed to patriotic Spanish-sounding ones after the massacre. It was part of Trujillo's plan to Dominicanize the border. And back when Paulina was a kid, she said Dominicans didn't live here at all. It was a totally Haitian town. Her family was mixed. Her mom was Dominican and her dad Haitian.
Tenía mucha vaca, muchos animales, puerco, vaca.
Her father, she says, was a wealthy man for the region. He had lots of animals, cows, pigs, there were coffee fields, and all of it stayed behind. When the massacre happened, her family fled to Haiti, and they lived on the other side of the border for many years. Eventually, they came back, though they never recouped the property that they left behind. And one thing that was interesting is that when I asked her about Trujillo, despite narrowly escaping slaughter during Trujillo's massacre, she says Trujillo was a good looker, a real gentleman, a caballero. That's her impression from watching a Colombian soap opera about Trujillo's life. And despite being half Haitian herself and living in Haiti for much of her life, she still spoke negatively about Haitians.
Hay haitianos que son frescos, hay haitianos que son atrevidos, abusadores.
As we mentioned earlier, Haitians and Dominicans in the border area live together peacefully, according to the research of historians. Yet, after the massacre, anti-Haitian attitudes grew and grew. And so Edward Paulino, the historian we spoke to earlier, started to ask why. And he found
the violence came first, and then came the ideology.
In other words, after the massacre, an anti-Haitian ideology sprung up, which Edward says was used by Trujillo to justify the massacre after the fact. That ideology was spread in newspapers, which Trujillo controlled, and in the work of intellectuals associated with the regime.
Trujillo capitalized on this historically but diffuse notion of Haiti as the outsider, as the enemy. And he uses the massacre then to crystallize this official doctrine that Haitians are eternal enemies.
And this is this classic thing that dictators and ultranationalists like Trujillo do, right? They create a boogeyman to rally the people against. In articles and books from Trujillo's era, Haitians were referred to as depraved and primitive. And this conflict between the nations was increasingly cast in racial terms, as supposedly virtuous white Spanish Dominicans versus bad black African Haitians. It was a predictable psychological trick that's been used time and time again. If Haitians could be painted as fundamentally bad, then the massacre could be painted as just. While I was on the border, I saw that ideology at work. It happened when Nancy took me to meet an older Dominican man. His name was Renami Ramos Torres. He lived through the dictatorship. He was a child during the massacre. And I asked him what he thought of Trujillo.
Bueno, la gente decía, mucha gente decía que era malo.
He says that a lot of people said Trujillo was bad because he killed a lot of people. But the thing is, you could go out at any hour of the night and nobody would bother you. There was respect. And when Nancy and I asked what he thought about Haitians, he said that back then, Haitians would steal children and eat them. What do you think about the Haitian massacre, Nancy asked. They had done a lot of bad things, and we had to get rid of them, he says. Trujillo wanted to clean up the country. And what do you think about that? Asked Nancy. Trujillo did the right thing, he says.
A 31-year reign of terror and bloodshed comes to an end in the Dominican Republic as dictator Rafael Trujillo is shot down by 7 assassins. His victims were numbered in the tens of thousands during his iron-fisted rule.
Trujillo was assassinated in 1961, but anti-Haitianism didn't die along with him. I spoke with Joel Martin. He's a musician who teaches Afro-Dominican music at the National Conservatory, and he's a friend of mine from when I lived in the Dominican Republic many years ago. But most importantly for our purposes, he grew up going to Dominican schools, which is where he learned about Haiti and Haitians.
But we're only taught about the moments that divide us.
Like when the DR fought for independence against Haiti back in the 1800s.
This really highlighted during the history lessons about how they, specifically they made mention of cutting the heads of Dominicans.
The Haitian massacre that Trujillo did in 1937 is in the history textbooks today. It's not denied anymore. But Joel says it's taught as a kind of footnote. And that's something that bothers Edward, the historian we've been hearing from.
Nowhere in the Dominican Republic can you go and there's a plaque for these thousands of men, women, and children who were slaughtered.
It's not just that there's no plaque. There's no museum, no memorial, no statue commemorating the massacre. Nothing. And Edward has spent a lot of time thinking about the question, well, why not?
Coming up on Latino USA, we try to answer that question. So stay with us, no te vayas.
If you find this Latino USA program about Haiti and the Dominican Republic interesting, you might want to go check out a companion episode that we produced with our friends over at Afropop Worldwide. It's called An Island Divided. It's about the long and complex relationship between the two countries, as told through music and culture. You can find Afropop Worldwide at afropop.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Piso mal.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm here today with producer Marlon Bishop. And we're talking about the Haitian-Dominican Massacre of 1937. Now, when we left off, historian Edward Paulino was asking this question. How is it that after 8 decades, why isn't there a single monument or a day of remembrance in the Dominican Republic for this massacre?
Yeah. So Edward Paulino, the Dominican-American historian that we've been hearing from all hour, he has this mission to get the Dominican Republic, the country of his parents, to confront the history of this massacre head on.
Dominicans are no different than their fellow citizens around the world, like the U.S. And how do you engage with the Confederate flag? Do you tear it down? Do you destroy it, right? The statues of Lee throughout the world.
Edwards says that when it comes to the Haitian massacre, Dominicans are facing these really difficult universal questions.
How do states and citizens bear witness? How do you reckon with the past?
And in the Dominican case,
the state has never apologized. It has never officially come out and engaged. And I think you have to talk. There has to be a catharsis.
But not everyone shares that perspective.
It's 2 volumes that touches on the massacre.
While I was in Santo Domingo, I visited Bernardo Vega. How many books have you written, by the way?
About 52, something like that.
Just a few. Bernardo is one of the Dominican Republic's foremost historians. And among those 52 books that he just mentioned, there are 2 that are only about the relationship between Haiti and the DR. I visited him at home in this multi-story penthouse apartment, replete with a library of Dominican history books.
So we are very upset at the fact that time and time again, this issue of the massacre is brought up when it was something that the Dominican people as a society were never involved in. I don't think that bringing this up again and again helps Dominican-Haitian relations. I think in Europe, the Germans have been forgiven by what they did to the Jews.
He told me he thought that it's mostly foreign academics or journalists who seem to be always trying to bring up this massacre.
There's nothing more to research. We don't bring it up. Trujillo did so many bad things. Why should we be responsible for it?
I don't know. I'm a bit surprised because, I mean, as a historian, I don't know. I think you kind of have to look at these things head on before you can move forward. So I'm a little surprised. I'm taken aback by that.
Well, I had the same feeling a little bit because historians are always saying, you know, if we don't talk about history, we're doomed to repeat the mistakes. And so I think his opinion comes from the perspective of someone who represents the Dominican nation also, you know, the statesman side of him. And he says, we want to move on. And this is Trujillo's fault alone. And it's ultimately, talking about this is divisive. It's not helping.
I guess what I'm getting from all of your reporting is, and from what I know is that it just hasn't been talked about all that much.
Exactly. And so the idea that there's no more to research, on its face, that seems like it's not true. Because to this day, people are still arguing about a basic part of the story, which is the numbers. There's huge disagreement about how many people were killed, from 30,000 down to just a few thousand. Edward Paulino uses a number around 12,000, which is what a Haitian bishop at the time came up with after interviewing refugees and asking them about their family members who didn't make it. Bernardo Vega, years later, wanted to try to calculate his own numbers, based largely on digging into census data.
In my studies, I estimate about between 4,000 and 6,000, although I have to admit that there's never been found any remains of Haitians in Dominican soil.
Okay, wait, hold up for a second. How is it possible that they never found any remains of Haitian victims after this massacre in the Dominican Republic?
Nope, none. So what does it mean that bodies haven't been found, most likely?
Well, there weren't that many. You know, after Trujillo was killed, there was a movement to try to find their tombs and do something, and nothing appeared.
Remember, people couldn't investigate until almost 3 decades after the massacre. And there are theories as to why bodies haven't turned up. Some say they were burned to hide the evidence or thrown into the sea.
That's the perverseness of it all. We can't find them.
Edward has another explanation of why nobody can find them. When he was doing his dissertation research on the border in the 90s, he interviewed Dominicans who participated in the killings.
I asked when I interviewed, I said, take me. He goes, and they used to tell me, no, it's, there's a road there, or yeah, I can't find it, or, you know, there's weeds. Yeah, you can't find it. You would think, oh, there's a farmer, they're farming, and they come up with a skull in the last 70 years. But part of the reason why, if the farmer did find it, is because of the culture of silence that the dictatorship bred and that still remains as a residue.
By culture of silence, he means that even if somebody did find a body, they probably wouldn't report it because there's still a lot of fear. Edward participates in a kind of DIY commemoration of the massacre called Border of Lights, which happens on the border during the anniversary in October in the city of Dajabón. It's put together by an international group of scholars, activists, and writers, many of which are Dominican and Haitian Americans. And the first time they did it, he remembers going to a mass that was held by the local Jesuit father.
He says, I've been here more than 20, 30 years. And this is the first time when these, you know, young people organized to remember this, the first time it's been talked about. And he was telling in a mass, you know, talk, it's okay, Trujillo is dead. Why the fear? And we know why. Because the DR, like many other post-dictatorial nations around the world and their citizens, experience post-traumatic stress.
To talk about the massacre, it's not just to talk about the massacre. It's talking about all of Trujillo's crimes. And it's about really confronting this greater trauma of the Trujillo years, of exorcising Trujillo's ghost once and for all.
I want to quickly remind you that in 2014... there were about 100,000 Dominicans who gave their signature on a list asking for a truth and reconciliation kind of commission for the crimes committed during the Trujillo dictatorship. There's a yearning for that. And the 80th anniversary, I think, is a window to understanding all these questions.
On one small scale, I feel like I did see that reconciliation in action. In the case of Nancy Betances, my Dominican guide at the border. While we were driving from town to town, looking for survivors for me to interview, I started to realize that, in a way, she was the story, not the survivors. Remember, Nancy's grandfather was in the military and killed Haitians during the massacre, and she confronts that past constantly. I asked her if she loved her grandfather.
Ay, claro que sí. Para mí fue el padre que yo nunca tuve.
Of course, she says, despite what he did, I had to love him. He was the father I never had. Yet she rejects what her grandfather did and tries to make amends for the crimes that her family committed by standing up for Haitians in her town today. And that has had consequences. She told me a story. A few years back, a Haitian in her hometown killed a Dominican. Some days after that, people in town killed a Haitian man as a reprisal.
Lo mismo casi.
After that, a nationalist anti-Haitian group called the Defenders of the People put together a mob to go out and try to force all the Haitians in town and the surrounding countryside to leave. News reports from the time say they were armed with sticks and bats. The leader of this anti-Haitian group knew that Nancy worked helping Haitians, and he threatened her not to show her face in town. She had to pull her son out of school, and she says the nationalists also threatened to burn her house down. But Nancy wasn't intimidated. She says she worked with an NGO to continue to help Haitians, and she helped a Haitian family get out of town that was trapped in their house under threat from the angry mob. She helped send police to town to get the people threatening the family to leave. And as she tells this story, Nancy starts to get visibly emotional. Now people say that my grandfather defended the country, she says, and they attack me because I'm defending a cause that they believe I shouldn't be. And it hurts. While we were out on the road, Nancy wanted to make sure I got a chance to meet a man that could help explain how the massacre is connected to this dynamic today between Haitians and Dominicans, the dynamic that leads to situations like the story she just told.
Regino Martinez Breton.
Padre Regino is the Jesuit father in Dajabón. He's been an outspoken supporter of civil rights for Haitian immigrants. And he says there's a reason why Dominicans don't want to talk about the massacre.
Decir, divides y vencerá.
It's a classic divide and conquer situation, he says.
La élite dominicana le interesa mantener esa diferenciación para mantener el rechazo.
Haitians today, he explains, work for low wages and in poor conditions in the Dominican Republic. For example, in the sugarcane fields, in construction, as domestic help, all throughout the Dominican Republic, Haitians are everywhere in those fields. And Padre Regino's take is that it's in the interest of the country's rich to keep Dominicans and Haitians thinking of each other as enemies, because that makes it easier to exploit these Haitian workers. And so even years after Trujillo is gone, his anti-Haitian ideology is still convenient for those in power.
El haitiano a nivel de la población.
Dominicans can love and defend their Haitian neighbors privately, but they don't dare to support Haitians publicly. And so they fall into step.
So, Marlon, you kind of went down the rabbit hole with this story of the Haitian-Dominican border. Do you feel like you've kind of figured it out in the end? And is there an understanding now of why it's worthwhile for all of us to study an event like this in world history?
So, yeah, I went into this story, I guess, from an American perspective, you know, thinking about our own border dramas. And I wanted to ask the question of how did things get so bad on the Dominican-Haitian border that they led to this massacre, right? And I think in the end, the massacre was Trujillo's way of marking the border in blood. And this division was made in such a violent way that afterwards, it kind of made it seem that Dominicans and Haitians had always been at each other's throats, which isn't the full truth at all. Edward Paulino puts it this way.
Chichimanda, the writer, talks about that there's one lie and one story and one narrative, and that's it. Dominicans and Haitians have never gotten along, and Dominicans hate Haitians. Well, if you go to the border region, it's not just about wars and massacres, but it's also about these two peoples coming together and sometimes making one people.
And so I started thinking about this idea of what makes up a nation or a people, and that it has so much to do with the stories we tell ourselves about who we are. And in the case of the DR, the story that Trujillo promoted and to some extent just keeps being told today is that Dominicans and Haitians are these eternal enemies, as Edward said, you know, that Haitians are invaders in one way or another throughout history. And the massacre in 1937 of Haitians, who are these long-term residents of the border era and who are living peacefully alongside their Dominican neighbors, that tells a different story. And that's why it's rejected, because it's hard to fit those two stories together.
You know, Marlon, I've been going to the Dominican Republic for 25 years.
And this is because your husband's Dominican and your kids are half Dominican.
Exactly. Yeah. And when I'm there living it, I do see that people are getting along and that people have these relationships and that, you know, the borders between people get really fuzzy in the Dominican Republic. But I also know that there are people that say things that I have heard come out of their mouths that are shocking. So, like, both things exist at the same time.
Yeah, and I think when this kind of all clicked for me was while I was on the border and I was driving with Nancy Betances, you know, she's the woman we've been hearing from whose grandfather was involved in the massacre as a killer. And she wanted to show me this one place. We were driving through the mountains near the border and we took this little road and all of a sudden we turn a corner and there's this thing in front of us in this clearing.
So here I am in what feels like the absolute middle of nowhere, and there's this completely giant monument, this like huge cement structure, at least 100 feet tall.
And it was really just kind of stunning. In a big clearing in the forest, there's this huge kind of brutalist thing, two giant pieces of cement on a raised platform, one horizontal and one vertical, with a bronze relief depicting this battle. And Nancy explained to me that this monument is a monument to the War of the Restoration, which celebrates not the wars between Haitians and Dominicans, but another event wherein Haitians and Dominicans worked together to kick out the Spanish, who had taken control of the DR for a few years starting in 1861. And it struck me that this monument represented this whole other possible narrative, not of Haitians and Dominicans in this eternal fight with each other, but as good neighbors, as people working together towards a common goal. And just like the massacre itself, It's kind of hidden away in the forest, you know, kind of just out of sight.
Thank you so much for your reporting, Marlon.
Thanks, Maria.
And that's it for today. Our show was produced by Marlon Bishop, and our team includes Fernanda Chavarri, Andres Caballero, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Shu, Zakia Gibbons, Noam Hassenfeld, and Joaquin Kotler. Our senior editor is Nadia Raymond. Additional engineering help this week from Stephanie LeBeau. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McMoyler. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelhotz. Our interns are Mallory Shingle and Liz Tung. Special thanks this week to Jimena Conde, Jennifer Celestin, Allison Corbett, Nancy Betances, Robin Derby, Edward Paulino, Richard Turitz, Steven St-Pierre, and Tatiana Fernandez. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and I'll see you on Instagram.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.
Grábame mucho. ¿Cómo me grabas?
The next day.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, rock and roll is hard to resist.
Before he threw the song away, he just left the bass and the drums. And my part.
We revisit the stories of the Latinos who helped shape rock music. That's next time on Latino USA.